The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dr. Donna Hicks. Dr. Hicks is an associate at the Weatherhead Center for International Affairs at Harvard University, where she was deputy director of the Program on International Conflict Analysis and Resolution. She worked extensively on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In addition to her work in the Middle East, Dr. Hicks founded and co-directed a 10-year project in Sri Lanka. She has also worked on the conflicts in Northern Ireland and Colombia and conducted several U.S.-Cuba dialogues. She is the vice president of Arapaces. Did I pronounce that correct?
Arapaces,
an Italian non-governmental organization based in Rome. They are currently involved in Dignity Restoration Project in Syria and Libya. Dr. Hicks was a consultant to the British Broadcasting Company, where she co-facilitated encounters between victims and perpetrators of the Northern Irish conflict with Archbishop Desmond Tutu. She's the author of the book Dignity, Its Essential Role in Resolving Conflict, which was published in 2011 by Yale University Press. And she has a new book. It's called Leading with Dignity, How to Create a Culture That Brings Out the Best in People. Dr. Hicks, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
I was intrigued right away in your new book that your approach to applying knowledge and practices around dignity in the workplace didn't emanate from a business school. They came from your experiences on the world stage dealing with international conflict. And I'm going to quote you. You say, quote, "I quickly discovered that conflicts in the business world share many of the same core drivers that are present in international disputes. The common denominator is the human reaction to the way people are treated." Talk to us
about
that.
Yes, that was... I was surprised because I just didn't imagine, first of all, I didn't imagine that I would be going into the corporate world to do consultations there. But I was, you know, just one day I was asked, had a phone call from a consultant who was consulting for a major corporation here in the U.S. And he asked me if I would be interested in coming into, you know, to this corporation because they had some terrible employee management conflicts. And he said he'd seen my work online about dignity and in the international field. And he said that he thought, based on what he'd read of my work, that this would be exactly the right framing for the issues that he was dealing with. And, you know, they were just having a terrible time trying to resolve these issues. So lo and behold, I took this foray into the corporate world. And, you know, I realized that absolutely the conflicts that they were experiencing between labor and management had serious dignity violations and serious unaddressed dignity violations at the core of those issues that divided the employees and management. So, I mean, I was as surprised as you know, anybody else, but the more I dug deeper and deeper into the, you know, the narratives on both sides of the divide, the more I realized that even though they may have been talking about things like pay and, you know, equity, you know, being treated equal, mm-hmm. all of that. But underlying it were these core dignity assaults that hadn't been addressed.
Isn't it funny that we have all this knowledge and evidence on the human condition, and yet it seemed for years and years and years it was never applied in the workplace, as if there was something different that we just changed as human beings when we entered these rooms where we were forced to wear ties, perhaps, when it seems so strange and artificial now that we ever even thought that way.
Well, you know what? I mean, Kelly, what surprised me the second, so many things surprised me, but what I realized when I started delving into this issue of dignity for my international conflict work was that nobody had really used the concept to frame what was going on between the parties in the conflict.
Right.
It hadn't been done before, and I was so surprised because having, you know, sat at so many of these tables all over the world, I could see the patterns repeating over and over. They were trying to discuss the political issues, but underneath it were these seething dignity, you know, mm-hmm. dignity assaults. So, so it doesn't surprise me that people in the business community never had been exposed to this because it was nowhere in the literature.
Right.
I searched everywhere. So, and you know, here's the thing. You're so right that this is a fundamental aspect of our humanity. Deep, deep issue when it comes to what makes the human beings suffer and what makes human beings flourish. But yet, our ignorance around it is, you know, I like to say it's encyclopedic. You know, right. It's just limitless, our ignorance. And so what I was forced to do in order to try to make some practical application of this idea to both the workplace and to international conflicts is I had to make it concrete. I had to make it usable. I had to come up with 10 ways that people want their dignity honored and 10 ways that we violate our own dignity. And so I think the contribution that I made was not so much coming up with a new idea. I mean, dignity has been around forever. It's just that we haven't thought about it in terms of conflicts. We haven't thought about it in terms of what contributes profoundly to the quality of our lives and of our relationships. And I think I just took that deep human issue and concern that we all share. We all want to be treated well. And applied it in a practical way. And I just think that having the language to talk about something that feels so bad. You know, how many times have we walked away from an interaction just feeling miserable? Like, oh, yuck,
yeah.
That was awful. But if you're able to frame that and if you're able to think about that as an assault to your dignity, then, you know, it's so much easier to kind of let it go, and it's easier to be able to heal from it because, you have a name. You can say, well, my identity was assaulted here, or I wasn't treated fairly, or I was excluded from that, you know, from that meeting. So having the vocabulary, I think, Kelly, was what really did it, in both in my community, in the international sphere, but also in the workplace.
Yeah. So when I was telling people I was going to have you on the podcast and I said the book is about dignity, they did that little thing like when you say something to a dog and it kind of tilts its head and they're sort of like, what?
Yeah.
Like in what way? And so the thing I gleaned, because it's early in the book, is you talk about this idea that dignity is not the same as respect. And I immediately sort of like, oh, I actually thought those two things were the same thing, but you see it differently.
Yes, definitely. I see it differently. And I think there's so much confusion. And in fact, you know, I hear it every day on television. People say, oh, well, we want to treat them with dignity and respect as if it's all one word.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, dignity, I think, I define it very simply as our inherent value and worth, that we were all born with dignity. And, you know, when I'm giving a talk on this, I usually have a slide of a little infant baby and beautiful, precious infant child. And I say to people, is there any argument that this little one, you know, precious newborn has value and worth? And I say, in fact, it's invaluable.
Yeah.
This precious life is invaluable. And so that's the simple definition of dignity. Now, and that is that it's our inherent value and worth, but respect, I think, has to be earned.
Mm-hmm.
And the way this came so clearly to me, the insight Kelly, was that when I was working in these international conflicts, people demanded respect from the other side. And I remember thinking to them, you know, that's a bridge too far. What you really want to be saying is that you want to be treated with dignity. You want to be treated as a valuable human being with inherent worth. And so I was able to get them to switch this in their minds that, yeah, of course we want to be treated with dignity. Because respect, I think when I say I respect someone, I say, oh, my gosh, I admire that person so much. He's done something remarkable to earn my respect. Whereas with dignity, we're all born with it. You know, it's just part of our birthright. So making that distinction has helped people a lot, because when you're in a conflict with somebody, the last thing you want to do is respect the person, right?
Right.
But you can through a good process, you can figure out how to treat that person with dignity in a way that will end the conflict and will, you know, address the underlying wounds. So this it's possible.
Yeah, this happened to me reading your book. So I sent someone a real shitty email. And and they had disappointed me, and I think my disappointment was valid, but I certainly used an emotional situation, a charge really took. I was attacking their dignity, and I'm literally, so I did this, sent the email, and then I had to prepare for the podcast, so I started reading the book, and then I just have to put the book down, and I'm like, oh no, I just did this, and then. So I wrote a new email and basically said, hey, you know, I did not give you context for why I was upset. Let me do that. Here's what happened. I was not happy that it happened. However, the way I communicated this was not okay, and I want to let you know that I'm very sorry.
Wow.
And it was really, it was like, and someone, because I had another colleague I sort of let know about, and he goes, hey, good job taking the high road. And I'm like, the high road sucks. I mean, it's really hard.
It's hard.
And it is. And I think that this idea of you should respect someone's dignity. That doesn't mean you need to respect them.
Exactly.
And they can lose that respect, but also that you can be rescued from acts of dignity peril, or you know, that you, and it's not just saying you're sorry. Sometimes you have to do more, but that's at least a starting point.
It's a starting point. Well, first of all, how did the person respond with your second email and apology?
He was relieved because I had made him really question, you know, like he felt really bad about this situation.
Uh-huh.
And so, and I knew that, and it was like, but you know, you can let your, and there's a power dynamic, right? This is someone, I'm more senior in the organization. They're right. More new. I just started again with this one, you know, this is the trouble with reading books, is you sort of, you now look at it a different way. And then when you can step back and allow, like, okay, I can still give someone a note, a serious note. I can be upset, all those things, without attacking how they are at core, because that's been done to me. This is the thing.
Support all of us.
All of us.
Yeah.
And like,
it sounds like you've handled that beautifully, though.
Well, the book helped in terms of reading this. So I wanted to dig into another thing that was kind of, this is kind of interesting, because we have a project that I talk about a lot on the podcast. We work with the Center for Decision Research at Chicago Booth, studying behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And the way this started was that I was on book tour for my book, Yes And, which is about how we take improv into businesses. And I would often go into bookstores to see if my book was there, which is what authors do. You know, everyone who says they don't do that is lying.
Sure.
And I would go to the business section, which I normally, in previous life, I was a fiction a reader. So I go to the business section and I'd see all these books on the art of negotiation, many of which spoke about the need to sort of be an improviser, but didn't go deeper. And I Googled academics, negotiation, Chicago, which is how I ended up in the office of Eugene Crusoe and Heather Crusoe at Chicago Booth. And we ended up not doing the negotiation thing, but going into improvisation as behavioral science. But I think it's all kind of connected. It feels to me that this idea in improvisation where you're taught to bring a brick, not a cathedral. This is how you co-create together. You have to be others focused. You got to look for the yes, not the no. And that applies to negotiation. And I don't think that it's a huge leap to say it's also potentially connected to a practice around dignity.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I just think what happens typically when, you know, when let's just say you have to go into a negotiation because there's some disagreement about the outcome, right?
Yeah.
And we tend to get pretty stuck in our positions, and we tend to get, you know, pretty fixed in our thinking. And I think that this whole idea of giving ourselves some time to create a different kind of space there, a space where you're seeking deeper understanding. And I think here's the connection, part of the connection anyway, but you're trying to expand your repertoire of thinking about, you know, of ideas about, well, what is possible here, mm-hmm. you know? And I think this is where I don't know that much about the innovation approach, but just listening to you, I think it is giving, it's not only giving you, but it's giving the relationship the, you know, sort of the benefit of the doubt that there might be another way to look at this. There might be another way to explore our options. There might be another way to look at what the bigger framing is and the context. So I think they're all related. Because, yeah. you know, it goes deep into trying to understand someone
yep.
and
yep.
giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah. And when we started digging into this work at University of Chicago, we were learning about things like this idea around self-verification theory, which is the idea that people want to be seen as they see themselves. And
sure.
that's different than the way of like thinking that someone just wants to be seen as their best self. If you can know that there's another layer there, that allows you to like get a little bit closer to someone else's truth. And I wanted to talk to you too about this idea around how I'll quote you in the book. You say, quote, "If we mistakenly think our dignity comes only from external sources or from the way others treat us, we're giving up a tremendous amount of internal power."
Yeah.
So we can do this to ourselves, right? We can take away our own dignity.
Oh my gosh. So I have to tell you a story because, I mean, I do write about it in the book, but it's worth repeating here now that, you know, I learned this idea that, that our dignity, right, fundamentally is in our hands and our hands only. And we mistakenly, and again, Kelly, this is part of the ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
We think that we can only feel good about who we are, or feel worthy when other people treat us well. Well, I mean, Desmond Tutu, when I worked with him, he was very clear with me and very almost harsh with me, because at one point I said, you know, I think people can have their dignity stripped from them. And he looked at me and he said, no way can people strip our dignity from us. He said, how do you think we blacks in South Africa got through apartheid, you know?
Right.
He said, we knew that the only thing that we had in our hands, we had left was our dignity, and we weren't willing to give that up for anything. So, you know, it's just this fundamental piece of self-knowledge that, yes, we are inherently, you know, worthy. We do have that fundamental sense of value and worth within us. But if we don't know that, if we think that, you know, it's that we only get dignity from the way other people treat us, think about all of the, what a waste of time that is, you know,
yeah.
precious time. And think about how depressed people get when they think that their dignity's been stripped, or think about the anxiety that goes along with that. So Tutu and Mandela both are really, really clear about this. And, you know, I think this was one of their biggest messages to the world, that don't ever think that your dignity has been taken away from you, because you lose the most powerful resource that you have inside as a human being.
And I think the other thing that you point out is, if you are operating with the idea that you do not have inherent worth, that you do not have dignity, there lies problems in relationships, problems at work,
yeah.
problems in society. You actually say that you're more likely to engage in face-saving behaviors. And I mean, I
sure.
again, you know, this week when we've sat through this testimony in Congress with Judge Kavanaugh and all the sort of side conversations, it's like, I feel like we're seeing this over and over and over again. This question of, you know, either stripping away, trying to strip away someone else's dignity, but also this sort of facade of not being able to admit to, you know, like we all screw up. There's so much shame that's at play right now.
Exactly. And you know what? I was just giving some talks yesterday, And one of the things that I told this the audience was that the biggest obstacle to living and practice living a life of dignity and practicing and leading with dignity is shame.
Yeah.
Because it, you know, there's nothing more frustrating than seeing someone that we know has made a mistake, and we know she or he has, just embarrassed to admit it. And yet, if that person just came clean and said, you know, look, I did mess up. I'm really sorry. I made a mistake, and you know, let's move on the rest of my life. I was really trying very hard to live a life of dignity, and I was really, hopeful that I could put my past to rest. And I mean, you know, that kind of reaction brings empathy from people, right? We feel moved when someone, especially a public figure, when a public figure actually admits making a mistake. What they fear is, you know, what they fear is that they're going to look bad in the eyes of others. But the truth is, I mean, maybe some people would not like it, but most human beings, when they see that kind of vulnerability, and when they are witness to someone who's struggling to try to maintain his dignity, and by admitting making a mistake and by taking responsibility, I don't know about you, but I mean, I turn into mush, you know?
Yeah.
I just think that is the most powerful, because in my mind, it takes strength to be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
You don't look weak. It's the opposite. For me, it looks great when you admit making a mistake, especially people in leadership positions.
Yeah, and Americans love second acts. I mean, that's the
I know
all about that. And you think about in the past, the people who have done this sort of face-saving crap. Bill Clinton, Lance Armstrong, Trump does it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, and
yeah.
It's and they do that same thing where they yell and kick and scream, and it's just not true. And it gets us nowhere, right? It's because you realize it is a dialogue killer. Because it's impossible. It's impossible to move forward.
No, it is, and it's very difficult to get over this sense of disgust that we feel by it, right?
Yep.
It is just it's heartbreaking actually to see, and it's tragic when we see it so frequently in our public figures, public officials and politicians and people in leadership positions. It feels even more more. Well, disgusting is the word that comes to my mind.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk a little bit about leadership in a business context, because you tackle this in the book. And one of the things you say is, quote, one of the greatest temptations that leaders have to avoid is believing in their superiority. So I get this. And I think what you're saying, too, is this idea that if you are not a lifelong learner, this idea that you've got some level of infallibility, all of that stands between you and the way things actually are and your ability to authentically work with the people who work for you.
Yeah, well, so one of the basic principles of my dignity approach, especially to leadership, is that we may differ in status. You know, you may be my boss. You may have more power of decision making and all of that because you're a leader. But I, as your coworker or perhaps not coworker, but one of your employees,
mm-hmm.
I may not have that status that you have. But when it comes to dignity, we are equal in dignity. And this is where the superiority-inferiority dynamic works and the power dynamic, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
That's the other thing we have to factor into here. And it's really what it is challenging that power dynamic and saying, look, you have, even though you have all this status and you have more, you know, capacity to affect me, the fact is, you know, a good leader and someone who has what I call dignity consciousness realizes that it's a slippery slope to start treating your people as if they're less than, right? And that you have such a superior attitude. I mean, this is, again, this is the kind of vulnerability when you recognize, you look at your people with whom you're working, who are working for you or with you, and, you know, to look at them and say to yourself, you know, I can see myself in that person's, you know, I can see myself in the other, because I know that our dignity, when it comes to our dignity, we are the same. So that takes a tremendously evolved person to understand that, right? That doesn't take away anything from his or her status or position. That actually expands a leader's ability to create a sense of well-being for everybody who works in the company. And it's one of these silly, unsubstantiated notions that, you know, because we have status, that means that we can do pretty much whatever we want. It's just not true.
Right. We had your colleague.
Not when it comes to dignity. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We had your colleague Ron Heifetz on the podcast previously, and you referenced this in the book in terms of his idea around leaders who need to both stand in the balcony, sit in the balcony, as well as the dance floor. And this element of the other person who talks about this is Ori Brofman and Martin Dempsey, the former Joint Chief of Staff. They wrote a book called Radical Inclusiveness, which is sort of this idea of, especially in a decentralized world, which we're increasingly encountering, the only way we're going to get to knowledge and truth is by being in as many places as possible to see as many truths as possible, because it's contextually, it changes from where you go. So you need to be kind of talking to everyone. This is where we talk about, because you talk about the sort of trouble with a top-down management system or a hierarchy, is it prevents you from doing just that, where, you know, a more flat organization, which allows, we have a term called follow the follower, which is an exchange of status. It's basically that when you're an improviser, you're doing both. Sometimes you're in charge and sometimes you're not in charge, and that can change in a split second, and that's okay.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, coming back to Ron Heifetz, and you know, I think what he argues, as you well know, is that anybody can exercise leadership, right? You don't have to be. And in fact, his whole adaptive leadership approach, I just did a segment in his leadership conference last week. So it's fresh in my mind. He asked me to do a dignity segment. But the thing is everyone has the responsibility to exercise leadership, or to try to look for where the dysfunction is in the work environment and try to address that. That he calls it, as you know, the adaptive challenge. So I think it's definitely a kind of thinking that is challenging all that top down stuff, and it's not just my work or Ron's, but like you said, there's plenty of other people who see this and who see the power of the inclusivity, like you said, and trying to take others' perspective and waiting, you know, holding back instead of reacting so quickly, just holding back and saying to yourself, what might I be missing here?
Mm-hmm.
Right? What perspective might I be missing? And that takes somebody with a pretty strong sense of dignity. And here's the connection, I think. Really, and I've argued this in the book, that what it takes, you need to have a firm grounding of your own dignity before you can do any of this, you know, very difficult exploration and inclusivity and getting to the balcony or whatever these challenges are.
Right.
You know, it really helps if you know, if you have that emotional scaffolding within you that says, no matter what happens, even if I make a mistake and I look bad in front of other people, I know I'm worthy. I mean, that's the platform inside that really enables us to do all these explorations.
Yeah, that's like when you're on the airplane and you have to put the oxygen on yourself before you give it to your kid. You know,
I always sort of smile when I hear that.
Yeah, yeah.
Flight attendants say that.
I know, I love it. All right, so we're coming close to an end, and I am going to ask you for a yes and story at the end, a moment in your life where you maybe normally would have said no, but you said yes. But I do. There's a couple more quotes I plucked from the book that I just want to get your a response from. One is, quote, "Social pain is as real as physical pain."
Oh gosh, yes, this is big. I mean, this research that I found when I was writing my first book just completely gave, well, it gave me the ammunition that I needed to have people in high positions take dignity seriously. And what that research was, that it was done by some social neuroscientists, and what they discovered is that when put in a brain scan and people were exposed to situations where there was a physical injury, mm-hmm. that it highlighted the part of the brain that is the ancient pain center. It's where all our deep emotions are felt, and you know, it's in the amygdala, the limbic system, for those who know this language. But and the astonishing thing that these researchers found was that not only does a physical injury light up the brain in that area, but wounds to our dignity also share mm-hmm. that same neural pathway. So, you know, basically what it is, you know, if you're rejected or excluded or any of these dignity violations, then that shows up in the brain, and the experience of it is the same as the experience of a physical injury. Hmm. So you can see why this was earth-shattering to me. This is exactly what I needed. And, I mean, they were the first. This is Matt Lieberman's work. Yeah. But since then, many people have replicated this. So now we have to take it seriously. The way we treat each other, ourselves and others, really matters. And so that's why I'm saying, you know, this is about the business community. I tell people in the business community, this is the most low-cost way of getting people, getting the best from people.
Right.
Because when they're treated well, they love it. You know, people will do more. They will be more productive. They'll give more discretionary energy. So it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Learn this stuff, right?
100%.
Learn it.
Higher retention, all that.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
The other quote comes at the end of the book where you say, after 25 years of working in the field of international conflict, it wasn't conflict I was interested in. What I really cared about was love. And I've talked about this a little bit on this podcast, and I was just interviewed for another person's podcast, and the concept of love came up, and how often we don't and we shy away from using the word. Less so in my field. In my field, actually, we say we love each other a fair amount, and I've had other people remark on it, being like, "Is that normal?" And I'm like, "Yeah, it's not normal where you are, and it isn't, right?" And it's like, again, we're not going to talk about love, and isn't that kind of maybe one of the most important things in our human experience?
Well, what I've concluded after working with this dignity model for over a decade now, Kelly, is that when two people are in a relationship and they use these dignity, you know, concrete ways of honoring each other's dignity, not only does the relationship, you know, flourish, but what ends up by happening is people feel a deep connection to one another.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of deepening your sense of intimacy with that person. And, you know, so, you know, I'm thinking, well, if you want to get better at loving, try honoring people's dignity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can have a loving experience and, you know, that great warm feeling when somebody honors your dignity and you honor theirs back. You can have that feeling with a stranger, you know.
Right.
It doesn't have to be a intimate relationship, but, you know, you could be in a checkout line and you could be having this lovely repartee with the cashier, and you're both laughing and you're both feeling, you know, that sense of being seen and connected. You know, this woman, Barbara Fredrickson, you should probably have her on your podcast. She's mm-hmm. great. She's the one that, you know, she wrote the book Love 2.0.
Yep.
So anyway, I think, you know, the fastest way to love is to honor people's dignity.
I love it. Okay, so we want a yes and story from you. And in the parlance of improvisation, we know when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they can't say no and they can't just stop at yes. They have to say yes and. And I'm curious, in your life, have you had those moments or a moment where you normally would have said, no, I'm not doing this, and instead you said yes and?
Well, yes. And it was the reason for writing this book. My background is I'm a conflict resolution professional, and I've been working, as you know, all over the world for about 25 years on these very intractable and difficult to resolve conflicts. And when I got this phone call, you know, I started out by telling you I got a phone call from a consultant in the corporate world. My initial reaction was, why is he calling me? What is he, you know, I said, and I'm thinking, oh, he's, you know, part of me is thinking, gee, this is a waste of time. I've got work to do, right? Mm-hmm. And then the more he starts talking, you know, and asks me if I would come and do some consulting, my initial response to that was, no way. Are you kidding? That has nothing, my work has nothing to do with, you know, the business world. But then I started thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, to myself in this fraction of a second, because my instinct was to say no. But then I said, well, wait, this is really sounding familiar, what you're telling me. So I, you know, of course, because, you know, my day job is international conflict work, I just, if I hadn't said yes and to this guy, to this consultant, I would have never written this book, right?
Yeah.
It opened, I said yes and to him, and it just opened my world in a way that I would have I never dreamed. I never dreamed I'd be writing a book on dignity and leadership. Just never did.
The book is called Leading with Dignity, How to Create a Culture that Brings Out the Best in People. Dr. Donna Hicks, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, I've been working in a coal mine.